Hi, guys.
Hi.
I'm a grateful recovering addict named Deb. And my, can you hear me? I'm not like blasting. Oh, good. My clean time date is August 1st, 2002. So August, I got 18 years against all odds. I just want to say that I believe that all of us are here against all odds. And we are all miracles. It takes some people a little longer, and then it takes a few of us to get God-smacked into the rooms. That would be me. First of all, I want to tell you about this nightmare, because you're my family, you're my tribe, I can say anything. I had a nightmare last night that I got up here to speak, and my fucking teeth fell out. Oh, sorry, my gosh. Oof, I'm trying not to cuss. Anyway, yeah, that was my nightmare. But you know what? Thanks to the program and my family in Narcotics Anonymous, I have teeth that can fall out. And if they fell out, I'd put my mask on and keep on speaking. I am the oldest of six kids. And a lot of you guys know my youngest brother. He is in the program. And out of the six kids, four of us are addicts. My youngest sister died of this disease and cancer. The other one does the other fellowship. But we are all clean to this day. And that's a really good thing. I was raised in Flagstaff, south of Flagstaff in Munns Park. And in 1967, we were one of three families that lived there. And it's in the woods. And everybody here knows I freaking love the woods. And I was always on my horse. On the outside, it looked like we had everything. I had a horse. My brothers had motorcycles. We had snowmobiles. But behind closed door, we had a father with a raging temper. He was physically, verbally, and emotionally abusive. He was very controlling. And he frequently took that rage out on my mother, and we would witness this. I used to hide the kids under the staircase so they couldn't see it. But so up until I was 17, I never experienced anything other than at 9 years old, I ate a whole bottle of Vicks Vapor Rubs thinking it would kill me. And I was 9 years old. And so my addiction started long, long before I picked up drugs. And so we moved to Tucson when I was 17. And Tucson has a nickname, Two Stoned Arizona. So it's a border city. There was every kind of drug everywhere, and I did every kind of drug everywhere because I liked the feeling of numbing whatever shit was going on. I'm sorry, I'm trying not to cuss. It slips out. Sorry, guys. Anyway, and so I also had an insatiable appetite for the fast lane. Wild. I was wild. I was out of control. I would get dealers as boyfriends because I just liked the lifestyle. I liked the money. And so I wasn't just addicted to the drugs. I was addicted to that lifestyle. And I wanted in on the action. And so then I would clean up and go back to church. It was like these 150% each way. And then I'd be in church, and then I'd hear the players on the devil's playground saying, "Come on, little girl, come back out here. You're still young." It's boring. I wanted excitement. So I would go back out, and it would be this way my whole life. And every time I went out, oh, I forgot to tell you, too. I have bipolar disorder, so I have a dual diagnosis. And so every time I would go back out, I would be 10 times worse and exasperate my mental illness. And so I don't want to mention certain drugs, but can you imagine this addict manic on Go Fast? Then on one of my last times out, I would get pregnant with my oldest daughter by a narcotics agent set up in the gym where I work to get information from me. And I cleaned up. I even got married in the church and had another child. When she was three, we decided to go on late trips with my brother. And the biggest lie my disease can say is, it's okay to have a couple beers after you got some clean time under your belt. It starts the escalator ride right back out. It always does for me and always will. I am an addict. So I ended up getting divorced and losing custody of both my daughters. And I married a drug dealer. And this was a bad drug that he was selling. It was methamphetamine mainly, but it was everything. And so soon my life became not an insatiable appetite for the fast lane, but a living madness. It was madness. And there was one day that I had to sign, I had to sign adoption papers over to my brother for my oldest daughter. And I was on a chaotic self-destruct after that. I felt like I had failed God at the most important job I was here to do. That was to be mother. I had failed everything. I hated myself. And I had a death wish. And I was crazy. I mean, even people called me Crazy Deb. And so I just, being in this mad world of dope dealing, so, you know, being in sales and distribution of illegal substances, I built this alternate ego, like a persona. And I think that we all do this when we're out there, because that's not the real us that's out there. And so when I came into the room, I didn't even know who I was. I had built my identity on that. And really, I thought that I was this badass chick slinging dope and pistol packing. And I really, inside, I was a broken, hurting little girl. And so my husband ended up getting raided, and he went to prison. And so I tried to launch out on my own. I had four girls, but I was never satisfied with the dope. I wanted to eliminate the middleman, and I wanted it straight out from the main guy. So the last boyfriend I had, I finally got introduced to the guy who had it hot off the press, if you know what I mean. And I dumped that boyfriend for this guy. The only thing is, this guy was scary. And the people that he hung out with were even scarier. And I used to pride myself that I didn't get paranoid on my drug, you know, like everybody else. I was the one that would rescue guys hiding in the dumpster, thinking the whole Tucson Police Department were after him. But when I was around this guy and these people, I was paranoid. I always had this feeling of dread, and the energy was dark and thick, and I was scared. I was really frightened of these people, because he had me see things that I should have never seen, and he subjected me to all of it because he wanted me fearful. That's how he controlled his women. Well, one day, two old ladies pulled me in the bathroom, and they said, "Get away from this guy." The last girl that he dated was a stripper, and she wound up getting shot in the head and burned up in her car out at an abandoned airfield. And I knew about it because I'd seen her on the news. And so I got scared. And when the going gets rough, Deb disappears. Even my family will tell you that. I left town. He had taken over my girls, my business. So I left town, didn't answer his call, didn't answer his text. And while I was away, the boyfriend that I dumped him for told him that I was a snitch and that I was a paid informant, and even showed him some custody papers from the sheriff's department, because we sued the sheriff's department for my first daughter. And he showed him those papers, and he put a price on my head. So I came back from Tucson, and two guys agreed to take that price, and I was hiding out in an apartment. And, wow, I haven't talked about this in a long time. It's hard to go back there, you know. I was picked up. I tried to jump out of the car and run. I was stabbed in my knees. I knew what they were there for. I told them, you know, you guys, I know my boyfriend thinks he wants to kill me. And he goes, no, he's not going to kill you. We are. And so I was duct taped and hands, feet, mouth. I was taken. I was beat. I was raped. I was tortured. And in the morning, they put a pillowcase over my head and threw me in the trunk of a car. And I was also stabbed, missed my heart by an eighth of an inch. I was bleeding out in this trunk, and I was scared. I felt alone, and the truth is I felt my living hell. I felt the absence of God. I didn't feel that anymore. I turned my back on him so many times. And I knew where they'd taken me. They were taking me to end my life. And so I am. Sorry. It's hard. I haven't been. Oh, thank you. I haven't talked about this in a long time, so it's hard to go back there. Anyway, they took me. They took me out to the same airfield. They took this girl. They were dragging me through the desert. And I heard a man yelling in the distance and a dog barking. And it was getting closer and closer. I felt the gun against my head. They shot it off in my right ear. And all I could hear was ringing, ringing, ringing. I was picked up and I was being carried. The man who rescued me that day was, he said his name was Robert Nathaniel Anderson. He was a 75-year-old retired Marine, and he carried me, I can't tell you how far. He burst into St. Mary's Hospital, and he told them, help her, she's bleeding out. And then I couldn't take my one eye that I had open off of him. He told them, let me give blood, I'm her blood type, and he was. And he stayed with me in the hospital for 3 days. He wouldn't let, I had ATF, FBI, because apparently my boyfriend had killed someone in Las Vegas and assumed his identity. I had the Tucson Police Department and Mantis at my door, all wanting to talk to me, and he would not let them. And so this man stayed with me for 3 days, and I used to think about his name because Robert Nathaniel Anderson, because before he left, he whispered in my ear this year, remember, you are never alone. And he put a Narcotics Anonymous meeting list and a white booklet on my bedside table, and he said, call these people, they will save your life. And do you know that after I got a year clean, my mom wanted to rent the church hall where we lived to honor him as a hero? And so I called the detective assigned to my case. He goes, it's a great idea. I'll get a hold of him. The detective shows up at my mom's house 3 days later and says, I don't know how to tell you this, but we've been talking to this guy on the phone like a couple months ago, but now when I call the number, it's not in service. We called the carrier, and they said it hadn't been assigned out in a year. And so we drove to the address that dude gave. It was an empty lot. So I knew at that point that that was a divine being that day, sent that day to save my life. And it hit me. It just hit me. And so I had called those people. One of the people that came to the hospital would be my sponsor. And I started working the steps. And I got to the fourth step. And I got stuck on fears because up until that point, I would not talk about what happened to me. I figured I survived. I'm here. I'm going on with my life. I don't want to deal with it. Well, I started having night terrors and flashbacks, and I would wake up in my closet in a full sweat. And I was in emotional turmoil. If you read chapter 7 of the basic text, it's called Recovery and Relapse. And there's a little formula in there that's headed for disaster. I was doing all of it. I was stuck. I was afraid. My sponsor called me and said, "Hey, Deb, what's going on?" And I copped a resentment. Fuck her. Oh, she doesn't know what I've been through. How could she tell me this? You know? And it took the wrong person at the wrong time to come over to visit. She said, "How are you doing, Deb?" I went to my guy, and he didn't have my drug, but I got yours. And I went on a 3-day binge. I relapsed. After vowing to God in the trunk of a car that if he would let me live through that, I would never use that drug again. And I had relapsed. I went on a 3-day relapse. We were in an apartment with a guy and a girl. And the disease of addiction had taken over my mind. But the seed of recovery had been planted, because my sponsor's voice haunted me, I swear. And pretty soon, by the end of 3 days, I was telling the girl, "Look, you can get your kids back. There's this program, it's called Narcotics Anonymous, and they will help you get your kids back. And you can go back to school. You guys have your whole life again. Don't look at me. I fucked up. I'm a fuck up." And so on the way home, you know, Newton's law applies to addicts too. What goes up must come down. I crashed. And on the way home, the diseased mind took over. I call it the Punisher, because he ain't got nothing nice to say. Anyway, that diseased mind took over and said, "Look, you can tell your mom and your sponsor that you got scared and you just had to leave for a few days. They knew you were having trouble." And then on the way, getting closer to the house, and by the way, you know, that was such shitty dope, I don't think it counted as a relapse. It was just a slip up. Well, I got home, expected an interrogation from my mom, and I vomited out my schmeal on her, and she just said, "Oh," instead of saying, "Where were you? I was worried sick. I thought they'd find you dead in a ditch." She went, "Oh, I'm glad you're home safe." I'm all, "Fuck, what's going on?" Well, my sponsor came over just when I was getting ready to crash in the room after 3 days of staying up. And I decided to vomit out that schmeal on her. And she said, "Dad, stop. We know you relapsed. This is not a me program. This is a we program. And when you want to finish and you've had enough, we want to help you." So she couldn't even get out the door before I fell on my knees and I surrendered. I was broken. And I realized that the first time my body was broken, and this time my ego was broken. And that's what it needed. Because I always thought, "I can do this. I can do this. I got this." Well, all that was the problem. Now it was time for the solution. And I dove into my steps. I wanted it. The readings came alive to me. And I understood the powerlessness of this drug over me. And I realized that I had a loving God. And I call him my God because, to me, he is my creator, he's my savior, he's my source, and he's the great spirit, all in one to me. And that's what this program gave me, a spiritual program. It gave me a spiritual God that, of my understanding. And let me tell you, I got help for my trauma. I started talking about it, and I hung on. I got back on my meds and stuck through the side effects instead of using every time the side effects got bad. And I let go of those reservations, let go of all of them, and I hung on to one promise that Narcotics Anonymous makes. Where is that? Oh, we don't have it here. One promise, one disease, one program, one promise. freedom from active addiction. That's the promise I hung on to. And I became a member of the No Matter What Club because getting high was no longer an option. I had to do this. I wanted to do this. And it meant never, ever, 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 ever picking up. Never, ever, ever, ever giving up. And so I learned surrender, 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 surrender. We call it reset, stop, pray, surrender. I learned that until it became acceptance. You guys loved and accepted me until I could love and accept myself. You know, since I even been clean, I've had a lot of shit happen to me too. But you know what? I don't give up. I was diagnosed 3 years clean with fibromyalgia. That's been a journey. I got the H1N1, the swine flu, got pneumonia and damaged the lining of my heart. And don't you know we have a hopping disease? So when I got clean, my disease hopped to food. I ballooned up to 220 pounds. And let me tell you, that was a struggle. That was a real struggle. But I realized that I didn't love myself yet. I hadn't forgiven myself. And my sponsor used to tell me that. You've got to forgive yourself. You have to let go. I used to say the words, but I didn't believe it. But soon after I did the steps again and again and again and again, I started to love and accept myself. And the layers of crap came off of me. I let go of shame, guilt, remorse, regret. And I started living like a healthy and believing like a healthy, vibrant person. And I would say that. And here I was, you know, over 200 pounds. But I started acting as if, fake it until you make it. That's what they say. That's what faith means to me. And I changed my perspective. You know, the most important thing I did was wake up with an attitude of gratitude and find five things that you're grateful for. And pretty soon I started loving myself and I got a healthy self-confidence, not from ego, a godfidence. Godfidence. My past is now like a page of a history book. It's still hard for me to go back. But I can get in front of a group of people like you and talk about it, whereas I couldn't even start to talk about it before. And I realized that the only time I need to look in the rearview mirror is to avoid trouble. The darkness has faded, and I am walking in the light. And I am so grateful to this program because what Robert Nathaniel Anderson said that day was true. The program of Narcotics Anonymous and all you, my tribe, you guys are my tribe, my peeps, saved my life. It saved my life. It's funny because I know that every time I call my sponsor, she's my rock. I know she has to brace herself and go, what's it going to be this time? But just hearing her calmness and her outlook of faith and positivity helped me change mine. So in the Living Clean, it talks about taking care of ourselves, body, mind, spirit. And I started doing that, and I dropped 100 pounds. It took me like 4 years to do it, but I did it. And I started thinking and acting and fake it until you make it. I love it. I used to get so pissed when my first sponsor would say, it is what it is. This is life on life's terms. Fuck her. She doesn't know what I've been through. But now I get it. I've come into acceptance. So when I was diagnosed in May, right when the lockdown hit, I was diagnosed with cervical cancer, but I had already gone through cancer with one of my sponsees. She had thyroid cancer, and I had already gone over the fears and having praying that my faith would be bigger than our fears. I walked through this with her so that when they told me, I was total peace. I was in acceptance that no matter what the outcome, I was in acceptance. And you know, I was facing two surgeries right when they locked down the hospitals. It's okay. I got into a surgery center. When they did the first surgery, I started thinking, acting. I've been doing that. Healthy, vibrant body cells, atoms. Started meditating on that. So when he did the first surgery, he goes, I can't believe this is the same tissue in the pathology. He goes, you don't need another surgery. You're cancer-free. Thank you. But I had to retrain my brain, you guys. We can't listen to the voice of the Punisher. He ain't got nothing nice to say. But our recovery voice, our spirit voice gets very strong. And pretty soon, this is just a barking chihuahua. And so I owe it all to you guys, the program of Narcotics Anonymous. I love you guys. And thank you for letting me speak. I am a grateful recovering addict named Deb. Thank you and God bless you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Deb. I'd like to introduce our next speaker. This is Ms. Hilda from Yuma. Please give her a welcome.
Good morning. My name is Hilda, and I'm an addict.
Hi, Hilda.
A very grateful recovering addict. I want to thank Nakona for asking me. Tommy, wherever you are, thank you for asking me to share a little bit of my story today. Thank you for sharing. I don't know how I'm going to top that, but I don't care. It's my story. You know? I like how you spontaneously said, fuck. But anyways, my story is I want to share my joy. I want to share my pain. I want to share my loss, but I also want to share my triumph. That no matter what, we stay clean against all odds. And this is very new to me. Not sharing, but new to this is since what I'm going to share with you. This is my first share at this level, and this is part of the healing of what we go through. So my name's Hilda. I'm an addict. I'm from Yuma. I was born and raised there. I'm the youngest of six kids. And when she shared that four of your siblings were addicts, three of us were addicts, same mom, same dad. And it's like, how is that possible? My sister is the total opposite of me, you know, but she's been my rock. She's been my all through my life and through my addiction. And now through my recovery, she's been there for me, and for that I'm forever grateful. I told the ladies there in the program that I was going to dedicate this to them, and this is a shout out to you ladies that you may find recovery, and that you may find peace through this journey. So I grew up a very insecure kid, and in piecing the puzzle of who I am today, I got to share a little bit of who I was. You know, I was very insecure. I grew up a very insecure kid, and to this day, confrontations are very hard for me. You know, I call it coward. I don't know, but at one point, it was my defense was humor, a lot of humor, I wanted you to like me, and I'd keep, you know, I'd keep quiet to keep the peace. So that went into my adulthood, and I've been married three times, but I've been a wife once. You know, there's this gentleman that I've never met but shares this, and I heard him say that he was married three times and been a husband once, and that's me too. You know, my husband taught me a lot, and I'm very grateful to be clean because this program taught me, like Angie says, integrity of how to be a woman, how to be committed and loyal and true. to somebody and in my life to all of you too, you know. There's four impacts. There's four dates in my life that have impacted my life. And that's the day my child was born. That's the day I got clean. The day that my husband died. And the day that my daughter died. My only child. Very life-changing in each of those dates have been very impactful. And we make it against all odds. You know? I know that... I don't know any of you. Well, I know my crew, even though I don't know you, I know you. Yeah. You know, we've been through pain. We've been through loss, of self-respect, loss of self-esteem, all those that our addiction took us to. But loss of physical pain of losing a loved one is what I want to share about. And it starts with a great friend of mine in recovery. She always shares about choosing life. And it's on the meditation, and I got to read it. I said, active addiction is a smothering death wish. Each of us courted death every time we used. Our lifestyles, too, put us at risk. The life of an addict is sold cheaply with every day and every dose. In recovery, the first pattern we change is the pattern of using. Staying clean is the start of our journey into life. But our self-destructive behavior usually went far deeper than our using. Even in recovery, we may still treat ourselves as if we are worthless. When we treat ourselves badly, we feel badly. And when we feel badly, we seek relief, maybe even in our old solution, the drugs. Choosing recovery means choosing life. We decide each day that we want to live and be free. Each time we avoid self-destructive behavior, we choose recovery. And that's me today. You know, I've been clean. My clean date is March 31st, 2013. I've been clean 7 years, 7 months, and 28 days by the grace of God. And I know that because I just looked it up. Anyways, the number seven to me is a very powerful number. It's in the big other book. It's a biblical number to me. But my mom was born April 7th. I was born August 7th, and my daughter was born December 7th. And this is my seventh year clean. So my God, man, thank you. Like I've heard it said, there's no coincidence. You know, only by the grace of a loving and caring God that I'm here today. I am truly humbled and grateful every day that I'm able to share a story of hope, a message of hope, that no matter what, we don't have to get loaded. So it was at MACNA this past year that my husband, we had been married 17 years, and he was a much older man, and he was a very kind man. But these last 3.5 years, he started getting really sick. And this last time he was in the hospital with pneumonia, and right after that they put him in a nursing home. And that's right when COVID hit. And I went in to take him dinner one night, and they said it was locked up. You can't go in. So I left, you know, I called him and I said, honey, I said, just hang in there. I said, I'll bring you home Monday. He goes, fuck that shit. I want to go home now. He was very insistent. But my dilemma was, that was MACNA convention. And, you know, I had always told him, you could mess with any of my other weekends except that one. And here he is in a nursing home. And I told him, how dare you want to go home if I want to share my, you know, my recovery with my family. You know, just wait till Monday and I'll pick you up on Monday. He insisted on coming home for whatever reason. And bless his heart, when I was driving home, I even told him, I said, don't even talk to me. I'm so pissed off because it's all about you. And here I'm thinking, really, Hilda? Really? So I take him home, and he kept apologizing. And later on, it just tore me. But at that moment, it didn't, you know. It was all about selfish reasons. And He knows I loved him. But anyways, so I get him home. I go to my convention. I get somebody to take care of him for me. And Saturday, I get home and share with him the neat things about the convention. And he's very restless. And I give him his night meds. And it's about 5:30 in the morning. And he yells out my name. And he goes, honey, he goes, I'm cold. Come and sit with me. And I go sit with him, and then he lays down, and he goes, pick me up. He goes, I can't breathe. And so I picked him up, and before I knew it, there's something inside of him that exploded, and he just fell in my arms. And I go, honey, he'd done that several times before, and I'd call 911, and we'd be okay. And then I called 911, and they got there, and I was waiting in the living room. And the guy goes, we tried everything. He couldn't come back. And here it is Sunday, the last day of Mackinac, and my husband's dead, and I'm broken. And so I call my family, and I call them, and Angie, as her aunt, she goes, you need to be with your family. And I went to Mackinac after the MEs and all that. They took his body, and I was there sitting alone at home. And I thought, I got to be there. I can't be right now by myself. And so I went, and I was loved. I was loved, and then after it was over, I went back home, and this is my new journey in life, you know, without my husband. But I have my daughter that will come and be with me because I'm alone. And the greatest thing about that one day that I had her was that I was hoping and praying that my child will change me. I was in active addiction when I had her. By all rights, she should have been taken from me, you know. And I had a little glimpse of hope that having this little girl would get me clean. But I took her through so much hell, and then I got clean. She was 9 years old the first time I got clean, because this is 7 years is from a relapse that I had, so I got clean, and she saw Mom clean for a little while, you know, from her drug of choice, you know. But I had a really bad gambling addiction when she was 8 months old. Up until 7 years ago, I had a vicious gambling addiction. You do the math how I had to pay for that shit. Anyways, I got clean, and she was into high school and her adolescence, and even though I wasn't doing my drug of choice, me and my husband would continue going to gamble, and still those years of her crucial years were not with her, you know. She had her friends. I go, come on, here's some money. I never told her no, because all the times that, you know, the years that I wasn't there for her, I thought this will make up for all those times that I told her no, that I wasn't there. So she grew up a very selfish, self-centered little girl, you know, but she was my little girl. And as the years went by, you know, she moved to Phoenix, and she, I remember she kept getting fired from Walmart. She kept getting fired from all sorts of, and then one day she goes, Mom, I'm going to apply for Wells Fargo. I go, you go, girl. I thought, yeah, she didn't get it, you know. She got it. She got the fucking job, you know. So I was proud of her. You know, you ain't stupid, Mary. You're just lazy or whatever, you know. And then she opted to be transferred with the company to Phoenix. And I said, don't stay in Yuma. I said, one of the things, before you know it, you're 30 and you're stuck in this little town. Live, Mary, live. So she moved. And then, you know, there's a song that says, I don't want to gain the world and lose my soul. You know? And that's what happened when she got to the big city. You know, I'd get to her apartment and help her clean, buy groceries, and I'd find these little laces, you know, and shoes, and I go, what's all this shit? Oh, it was a costume party, Mom. And I said, okay. So I found a little card that said dancer, and it wasn't ballet, you know. And I asked her, I said, honey, do you have anything to tell me? She goes, no. I go, Mom, I found your card, I said. And at that moment, it took me back to when she was a child. I held her in my arms. She cried to me, and I said, you're going to be okay. I'm going to love you no matter what. Because my mom always wanted me to perform to what she wanted. And at first, I wanted Mary to perform to what I wanted. Go to beauty school. Get a business. Get my business, you know. I wanted to mold her to my liking. And she was a little rebel. And at that moment, I said, I don't care what you do. I love you. And then, so the next journey was, you know, she continued in that life. I went home, and then she met somebody, and she says, Mom, I'm not dancing anymore. I met a man that took me out of that world. Well, this man took her every breath. She breathed through this man and for this man. So to make a long story short, I would hear, you know, my daughter would say, Mom, I'm only smoking pot. And her friends would say, you know, Hilda, she's doing other things. And I would justify her telling me, Mom, you can come up here anytime and you do a UA and I'm clean. So that would keep me at bay, you know, she's clean. And, well, after COVID hit, I was in quarantine for a month and a half. And I never heard from her. She never came to see me for when her stepdad and died. And all this summer I was working and I was working. It was April. It was August 13th. About 2 o'clock, the phone rings and I thought it was a scam call, and I kept ringing, and I answered, and it was the man's dad, her boyfriend's dad, and I thought, this is odd, and his voice was just not right. And he goes, we got home from work, and we found your daughter incoherent, in unresponsive. And I said, no, you're wrong. And she died on that day. And to feel, to reenact that moment where I'm told that my daughter had died, it's unexplainable. I ran into the salon where I work, and I told my manager, she's dead, and all these people were in there, and I think I must have fainted a couple of times, and then I called my family, and before I knew it, they were there and prayed with me and gave me the strength to get through this. I didn't use no matter what. You know, when my husband died, I came straight to a meeting, virtual meeting, but I went to a meeting anyways, you know. When my daughter died, I didn't use, you know. I accepted. I learned the deeper meaning of acceptance and surrender at a much deeper level. The God of my understanding has gotten me through so much. And yet, you know, we've all had losses, like I said, and I'm not the first, and I'm not going to be the last. But my pain is my pain, you know. And I don't know. There's days that I wake up and I want to say, I'm going to conquer the world. I'm going to face the world. And then one little speck of her thought breaks me. But I don't get high. You know, I thank God every single day for my life of recovery. And I want to share with you on page 33 of the It Works How and Why. It says, recovery doesn't exempt us from having to live through painful situations. At some point in our lives, we may have to mourn the death of a loved one or deal with the end of a relationship. When such things happen to us, we hurt, and no amount of spiritual awareness will take our pain away. We do find, however, that the caring presence of a loving power greater than ourselves will help us get through this pain clean. We may find that we are able to feel our God's presence in the group and our friends and in talking to our sponsor. And we can cease questioning why painful things happen and trust that walking through the difficult times in our lives can strengthen our recovery. We can grow in spite of our pain, or perhaps in response to it. In response to it. You know, I'm so grateful that I'm clean, like I said. I don't know what else to share that you know, I was talking to my friend Little Joe last night. He called me and he goes, Hilda, it doesn't matter. Just share your truth, share your message. Even if one person heard your message, that's enough. And if not, you stayed clean today, Hilda. I stayed clean. And then my friend, she goes, if I did anything right today, I don't want to use today. And I just, you know, after all this happened to me, when I hear a song, man, it's at a much deeper level when I really listen to the words now, you know. Like, before it was about the beat. Ha, Jessica. Anyways, I'm 55 and I went dancing last night. Shit, my knees are killing me today, man. Oh, anyways, but I had fun. Anyways, there's a song by Plum. It says, I need you now. And I'm just going to read a little bit. Okay, I'm not going to sing it. Don't worry. Okay? It says, well, everybody's got a story to tell. And everybody's got a wound to be healed. I want to believe there's beauty here. Because, oh, I get so tired of holding on. And I can't let go. And I can't move on. I want to believe there's meaning here. How many times have you heard me cry out, God, please take this? How many times have you given me strength to just keep breathing? Oh, I need you. God, I need you now. And that I say every day. You know, whatever your path, whatever your journey is, the God of my understanding has given me strength, has given me courage, has given me understanding of what is, you know. I don't question why me, you know. I can't keep questioning why this happened to me. And I could only share that there's hope. There's hope in every story, you know. I pray that we all find recovery at a deeper level. And I pray that we all walk this journey with peace. Thank you for letting me share.
Thank you so much. Let's give both.